This episode is brought to you by EY. How can EY teams help you create a better version of your company? We work with you to turn data into greater insights, invest to drive growth, and realize your strategic vision through thoughtful implementation. Visit ey.com/reimagine to learn more.
The countdown has begun. This May, 1,000 global leaders will gather in Doha for the Qatar Economic Forum powered by Bloomberg, held in conjunction with our official partners, the Qatar Ministry of Commerce and Industry and Media City Qatar, and premier sponsor QNB. Join heads of state, influential ministers, and leading CEOs to make new connections and gain unique insights. Learn more at QatarEconomicForum.com.
This is Bloomberg Business Week. I'm Carol Masser.
And I'm Bloomberg Quick Take's Tim Stenovek. We're here every day bringing you the latest news from the world of business and finance.
Plus technology, politics, economics, all harnessing the power of Business Week reporters and editors.
Not to mention our 2,700 journalists and analysts in more than 120 countries.
You can download Bloomberg Business Week on iTunes, SoundCloud, or Bloomberg.com.
You can also listen to our radio show at 2 p.m. Eastern Time on Bloomberg Radio.
Or watch us on YouTube. Search Bloomberg Global News.
Katie, something strange happening in homes across Texas, New York, Maine, and a handful of other states here in the U.S. In deregulated states such as these, customers are turned de facto natural gas forecasters gambling on the direction of highly volatile markets when it's time to renew their contracts. Michael Sasso is economy reporter for Bloomberg News. He and our colleague Noreen Malik write all about this phenomenon for Bloomberg News today. Michael, good to have you with us, joining us from our Atlanta bureau. What exactly is happening here? What are Americans doing when they're trying to, I don't want to say negotiate their energy bills, but figure out how they're going to actually pay less?
Yeah. Good to be here. I ran across this on a personal note when I was I happened to be in Atlanta area, and I had got my natural gas renewal contract for my heating. And it was up something like 60 or 70%, and I thought, what's going on here? And they're wanting me to sign a contract for anywhere from a year, 2 years, and I was thinking, how do I sign a contract when the it's sort of the top of the market? You know, my rates have, you want me to sign a contract for rates that are up 65% from a year ago? And the alternative was even better. If you don't want to sign a contract, you go for one of these floating or variable rates. And at this moment, those are up more than 100%, 150% from where I was a year ago. And that's just natural gas around the country. You mentioned Texas. Texas gets most of its power by burning natural gas, so its electric rates are sort of closely aligned with natural gas. And those people looking at 50, 60, 70% increases, and they're in the same scenario. They're in this no-win situation. Do they renew at these high rates? Do they keep going with variable rates with no promise that the prices are going to go down? It's a tricky situation to be in right now.
Well, tell us about some of the people who are in this situation that you spoke to for this story, because there's some great reporting in this piece about Floyd Stanley, for example.
Yeah, that was something my colleague Noreen, she talked to Floyd. She found him. He's in the Dallas area, and he's kind of going at it full bore. He actually has spreadsheets, and he's evaluating electric contracts. There's a bewildering array of electric providers in Texas, and he's spread charting each of them, and I believe, as I recall, he locked in a two-year rate because he was worried about rates going even higher, so he was trying to limit his damage. So there's Floyd kind of spreadsheeting things. Here in Atlanta, there was a woman named Ramona Sandro who was trying to make a natural gas calculation, and she too booked a two-year contract, worried that prices were going to go up even more. And then on the opposite end, there was a fella here in Atlanta who did the opposite. He couldn't stomach today's prices. He's kind of gambling that natural gas rates are going to go down. So he's going kind of naked. He's kind of the floating rate, even if it's above $2, a quote-unquote therm, which is more than 100% more than it was a year ago.
Yeah, I mean, so What about the millions of Americans who don't have a choice when it comes to this stuff? How are they stomaching it?
Well, I mean, we're all kind of paying higher rates, whether you have you're in one of these choice states or not. In a lot of cases, you are having to go with a regulated utility rather than a deregulated state. For people who absolutely can't pay, there is something called, it's an acronym, it's L-I, the word HEAP, H-E-A-P, so L-I HEAP, and that is sort of a federal utility assistance program that's kind of routed through each of the states. But as I understand, and we didn't write a lot about this, I did research it a little, this LI HEAP program is pretty much tapped out around the country. So unfortunately, I mean, I wouldn't want to discourage someone from trying it. It's certainly worth it. But as I understand, there's a tremendous demand and not enough supply of these assistance dollars right now.
Michael Sasso, economy reporter for Bloomberg News, joining us this afternoon on the phone from Atlanta. A really great piece highlighting the challenges that Americans are going through when it comes to figuring out the best way to actually pay for those high heating bills and when it comes winter, and then cooling bills as the AC has been jacked up for so much of the summer. We didn't even mention Europe, but they make a really good point in the story that prices are even higher in Europe. So important to keep that in mind.
You're listening to Bloomberg Business Week with Carol Messer and Bloomberg Quick Takes' Tim Stenovic on Bloomberg Radio.
Well, when it comes to crypto, one number that I like to use a lot, I'll admit it, is $3 trillion. That's at least the market cap of all crypto that it was at its high point a little earlier this year. Now, to get to that number, all you got to do is you got to take the coins out there and multiply them by the price of each coin. But the question is that the right way to value the crypto market? It's something that Vildana Heyrich spent a lot of time thinking about and talking to analysts and economists about. She's cross-asset reporter for Bloomberg News. Her story is in the current issue of Bloomberg Businessweek magazine. It's available on newsstands, on the Bloomberg, and at Bloomberg.com. Also with us this afternoon from the Interactive Brokers Studio is Joel Weber, the editor of Bloomberg Businessweek. Joel, am I doing it wrong? $3 trillion? Should I not be saying $3 trillion
anymore?
We're going
to, after this little segment, you probably won't be saying it anymore. But the question just came from, look, like as we sort of all plunged into crypto winter in summer, we just started asking bigger and bigger questions and then turning to our friends in the newsroom to help us try and answer some of them. And so the question that we kind of came to Vildana was, look, Liz, people say this is $3 trillion. Like, is it really? And boy, did she ever go down a wormhole.
It was a fun wormhole.
How far down? I mean, you went to the bottom of the wormhole,
like
right?
It was a rabbit hole better than wormhole.
That's rabbit
hole? Rabbit hole, yeah. Rabbit hole is more Alice in Wormhole.
Well, maybe in crypto. Yeah. Okay, well, okay. Whatever
wormhole
kind of hole it was,
crypto,
we went down it. And Vildana, what did you learn?
Well, I do want to give a shout out first to our brilliant editor, Pat Regnier at Businessweek, who loves to think of these big meta questions. And this was definitely one of them where it's like, okay, how big actually was crypto? Because as you guys were just saying, market cap, it's just you take the number of coins out there, you multiply it by the price. So is that really an accurate reading of the value of the crypto market? And if you really think about it, there's a bunch of coins out there that are so-called dormant coins, mm-hmm. meaning that they really haven't been moving, they haven't been used for anything in something like 5 or more years, meaning that potentially that they're lost. And then you also have all of these different projects that had been coming out where you have a founder throwing out like a random supply number. For instance, they'll say, okay, we're going to have 20 million tokens of XYZ project. And really, it's the founder who owns the majority of the project. So there were just a bunch of issues, and we really wanted to get down to this idea. Well, actually, how much were things worth if they weren't $3 trillion?
So where did you even start? Who did you reach out to? With a project like this, I feel like I would be chasing my tail for a few months, which
I think
is probably
I was.
Why they didn't ask me to.
Yeah, I was chasing my rabbit tail.
So who helped you?
Well, the first thing I did was I wanted to look at the number of participants. So in the U.S., at least, to try to get a read on how many people own or use or trade cryptocurrencies. And there actually is some data out on this. So we had a survey from the Federal Reserve. They had found that something like 12% of U.S. adults had held crypto last year. And then there was a survey from Pew that showed about 16% held crypto. So that's more than 50 million people in the U.S. And it's not an insignificant number. So it was a good starting point. And then I ended up calling a crypto skeptic. That was my very first phone call that I made. And he basically said, this is all BS.
Of course he used the curse word. Yeah, of course he would.
To say, well, Donna,
I'm not going to say it.
So in addition, you got the skeptic, but you also got some proponents and economists and everyone else. I'm actually really curious, like, how many people did you speak to? And of all of that universe of characters, who is the most colorful?
Well, probably the crypto skeptic was the most colorful, throwing out the curse words and whatnot. I spoke with a lot of people. There were a lot of people who didn't end up making it into the story because there's so many different ways to try to measure even just engagement. So trying to measure so-called entities, for instance, which is also just like the people who are participating on different blockchains. And then there's issues.
Or if they're even people, right?
Yeah, yeah. Or if they're even people, of course. But that's actually one of the issues. So you have so many issues behind a lot of these measurements where maybe you are counting one person as 10 different people because they have 10 different accounts or, you know, so it was really trying to figure out what is the best representation for some of these numbers.
So, Vildana, after speaking to the skeptic and Noelle Acheson, who you refer to as the researcher, she, of course, is of Genesis Global Trading, the data crunchers as well. How do you think about crypto differently after reporting this piece?
Well, one of the things that I ended up coming to a conclusion to was that there just had been so much leverage in the crypto market, where at the height, that 3 trillion number really encompassed a lot of different... I suppose leverage is the best word to use. There was just so much froth. So taking that froth out of the 3 trillion number and then coming up with something, you know, for the story, we came up with somewhere around 800 billion, somewhere around where the crypto market actually is currently, the market cap is showing us its worth.
Which is not nothing.
It's definitely not nothing.
Which is, I think, you know, back to the skeptic idea there. It's just like, okay, well, there's real money in here a little bit, right? And
definitely.
One thing that's significant there, though, is, as one of our colleagues was sort of challenging us in the newsroom, was, okay, wait, isn't this as much as it started with? So what just happened?
Right. So I think the best way, and one of the things that came up over and over again, so somebody I spoke with at UBS came up with this number, and then the two economist researchers from these big data crunching crypto firms, Chainalysis and Glassnode, which are both well known for looking at charts and trying to figure some of these things out, is they were all looking at something called realized value. And I hope I get this right. I don't want to upset any of the crypto fans out there, but that's basically just the prices that coins actually fetch in their most recent transaction. And if you look at that number, so Glassnode, for instance, can actually give you a ratio of the market value versus realized value. The ratio at the height was something like 3.2. And you take the 3 trillion divided by 3.2 and you get the sort of $850-900 billion number. That removes out all of that froth.
I can loosely follow that math. I would say I'm a little bit challenged in that area.
You start with 3 trillion and you end up with a smaller amount, but it's still billions.
I got it. I'm there.
Billions.
Is that good?
Many billions. Several hundred billions. But Vildana, we don't have much time left, but I am curious what the reception has been like, because I don't know, a lot of people were really married.
Cold shower.
go on.
Well, the one thing, so in crypto, if you end up writing about the crypto space, sometimes it doesn't matter if it's a positive or a negative story, you'll still get a lot of hatred on Twitter. Mm-hmm. So one of my things was, okay, don't at me on Twitter, no matter what I come up with.
Yeah.
And actually, all the at me's were very positive. People within the crypto space were very receptive to this idea that, okay, market cap is just not a good way to be measuring the space. This is a really good, insightful look at what the crypto market is actually valued at. And it's just interesting to take a look at some of these readings and technical measures like the realized value one.
So the internet is good.
Wow.
It's good today.
Okay, we'll just give it a few hours, Vildana, and I'm sure, you know,
we'll see how this
maybe I shouldn't have done this interview.
Yeah.
Crypto summer, warmer than crypto winter.
Love that.
Vildana Heirich, cross-asset reporter for Bloomberg News. joining us from the Bloomberg Interactive Brokers Studio. Check out her story. It's featured in the current issue of Business Week magazine, available on newsstands, on the Bloomberg Terminal, and at Bloomberg.com. A big thank you to the editor of the magazine, Joel Weber.
When cybercriminals strike, the difference between a catastrophic event and resilience is preparedness. Finance leaders who plan ahead can thwart the damage posed by ransomware. Yet in a recent EY poll, only 23% of directors expressed confidence in their organization's ability to respond to a ransomware attack. Cyber preparedness is just one facet of the complex risk landscape finance leaders face every day. Now more than ever, it's vital to keep ahead of developments. Cybercrime, macroeconomic conditions, ESG reporting. You can't predict the future, but you can prepare for it. By understanding your risk, you can make your business resilient to challenges on the road ahead. What's more, you can turn those risks into opportunities. EY helps CFOs, boards, and audit committees see beyond the numbers to uncover the critical insights that make their organizations resilient, even in an ever-shifting landscape. For more insights that matter, visit ey.com/beyondthenumbers.
I'm Alex Rodriguez.
And I'm Jason Kelly.
From Bloomberg, this is The Deal. Each week, you're here as in conversation with business icons.
This show will explore deal-making across sports, media, and entertainment.
That is a harsh lesson in business.
Sports is not as simple as bringing a bunch of big names together.
I didn't want to do another stomp you out speech.
It opened up so many more doors.
The show is called The Deal.
Listen to The Deal wherever you get your podcasts.
And watch on Bloomberg Originals, Bloomberg Television, or BTV Plus.
This is Bloomberg Business Week with Carol Masser and Bloomberg Quick Takes Tim Stenovic on Bloomberg Radio.
Well, meme stock mania, it's set to live on despite wild swings, at least according to our latest MLive Pulse survey. This story written by Bailey Lipschultz. Bailey is Bloomberg News equities reporter. He joins us live from Hoboken, New Jersey this afternoon. Bailey, how are you?
I'm doing well, Tim. Are you doing all right with COVID?
Everything? Yeah, I am. Thank you for asking. I feel great. The reason I ask how you are is because I saw on Instagram that you got engaged this weekend. So congratulations.
Yay.
Thank you very much, guys. I appreciate it. Yeah. Pop a question on Friday night. She said yes after many a tears were shed. So I'm officially engaged and have a fiance, which is weird to say.
We would have definitely not brought it up if she said no. Just know, I need you to know that, Bailey.
And she knows she's marrying the meme stock master, Bailey Lipschultz, which is fantastic. Bailey, it's really exciting. So we're sending you our best here from Bloomberg Business Week. We do want to talk about meme stocks, though, because the MLive Pulse survey is out, and it says that investors think that meme stocks are here to stay. So talk about the methodology here, because this is something that our MLive team does, and it gets a great idea of what investors are thinking about.
Yeah, so every week we run a survey, kind of try to be as topical as possible. So this was crafted really after the madness around Bed Bath & Beyond about 10 days ago, around that Ryan Cohen kind of boom and bust after he dumped the stock. But yeah, so nearly two-thirds of the 522 respondents, so we are polling both strategists and portfolio managers on the Wall Street, as well as retail traders who have the terminal and are responding through the terminal link. And really, the consensus for the most part was that even though you have kind of these boom and busts, whether it's AMC, GameStop, Bed Bath & Beyond, or even kind of the one-offs like BlackBerry and Cost Corp, there is an expectation that it will continue to live on in one way or another. And the real reasoning that I got from talking to some people about the idea is just that commission-free trading, so whether you now have the ability to trade out-of-the-money call options, or just buy the underlying stock at a fractional share, is going to continue to be a kind of thesis that Wall Street has to think about. And that's really being driven by things like Reddit, things like Twitter, and other chat rooms like Stocklist.
Okay, so I get the sort of market structure why. You do have basically free trading, et cetera, et cetera. Talk to us about the psychology, though, because we're in a very different place from when the meme mania first started, when people were locked at home. Now you're able to go out and do things. You might get COVID like our friend Tim did, but why is this still happening?
There's still just an ability and a kind of a mentality that you're bonding and connecting. So whether you're in a Reddit thread or a Discord chat talking about how you just bought more 8 preferred shares and you're excited about it, you feel like you're part of a movement, is the understanding. And really, if you kind of take that and add on the fact that in a market that for the most part still is beaten down. We still have pretty light volumes. Professional traders are more than happy to jump into some of these trends because it is an easy way to generate some alpha. And we are seeing, like, even with Bed Bath & Beyond today up about 30%, people are trading the call options for $45 strike price. The stock right now is at $13.50. So there still is very much that gambling aspect where investors, and whether it's retail traders, professional traders, are more than happy to speculate with a small portion of their portfolio, just given the potential returns.
Bailey, does it tell us anything about capitulation or about big picture how investors should look at a bear market when we have retail traders getting involved in companies like this?
Yeah, I mean, the real debate, and we kind of got a mixed reaction from both pros and retail traders on the idea that that investors need to become net sellers for the market to really bottom. But it feels more like it's kind of just an offshoot, and it's another area for investors to trade. You look at the memorabilia space, it still is booming, even with the market really struggling to find its footing. So I don't, as much as people like to connect the dots and say the Fed is going to have to continue to hike as long as Bed Bath & Beyond jumps 30% on any given day, it does feel like, in the consensus from some of the people I talk to, is that that's very much misplaced and an easy thing to say, but doesn't actually, at the end of the day, drive a core fundamentals for the market, just because in the broad scheme of things, these are very much small companies. While the percentage jump is massive, it's just a drop in the bucket, broadly speaking.
All right. Well, Bailey, before we let you go, meme stocks, crypto versus SPACs, what did you get from professional investors versus retail investors, just in 15 seconds?
Yeah, professional investors like crypto the most, as do retail. Retail was a little bit more optimistic on meme stocks. About 23% said that would be the best asset class. Professionals only said about 15%, but very much crypto between the three was the favored asset in the next year.
Bailey Lipschultz, equities reporter for Bloomberg News, joining us this afternoon on the phone from Hoboken, New Jersey. Big thank you to Bailey, and congratulations once again.
I'm driving in my car. I turn on the radio.
How about you let me drive?
Oh, no.
Who's gonna drive you home?
Honey, please, I'll do the driving.
Drive on.
Excuse me, I want to drive.
It's the question that drives us.
This is the Drive to the Close.
That funky music will drive us till the dawn.
On Bloomberg Radio.
Well, here we are, less than 10 minutes to go to the close of trading on this Monday afternoon. The S&P 500 is lower by 0.4%, as is the Dow. The NASDAQ, the laggard today, down by close to 0.8%, a little more than 0.8%. Let's get into it with Aaron Cannon, co-founder and CEO of Clear Harbor Asset Management. They've got over $1 billion in assets under management. Aaron joining us this afternoon on the phone from Stamford, Connecticut. Aaron, how are you?
Doing just fine, Tim. Thanks for having me back.
Yeah, it's always good to have you with us. I got to tell you, I was I'm working from home because I'm recovering from COVID, and I couldn't turn away last week in Jackson Hole, even though I was, you know, on a sick leave essentially. And I texted Katie afterward, and I was, as we saw the sell off happen, and I said, Katie, this is what we've been talking about for weeks here. Like, this shouldn't be surprising to people. We knew Powell was going to be hawkish. We know that inflation is the number one concern for the central bank. Why is everyone so surprised by this? So I ask you, why is everyone so surprised?
Right. So, I mean, I think the rhetoric has been consistent, but there has been a belief since perhaps mid-June that the Fed at some point, perhaps even by the end of the year, would be in a position where they're looking at data and decelerating inflation, and that they may, in fact, be in a position to pivot. And I think what we heard on Friday was that's not accurate. Do not fight the Fed. You know, if you're predicting a pivot soon, please do not bet on it. And so in some sense, I think the Fed was probably pleased with the market reaction, while investors clearly were not.
Well, we know. I mean, we know Neil Kashkari was pleased. He said that on the Onbots podcast a little earlier today. That story just coming out on the Bloomberg in the last couple of hours, Katie, right?
Mm-hmm. And I feel like, Aaron, Powell almost gave us a blueprint for how to invest in these markets, because think about what he said. He said getting a grip on inflation, it could necessitate a period of below-trend growth. And if that's the case, how do you structure a portfolio around that?
Well, it's tricky in the near term, but we're very much, you know, guided by a lot of the sort of thoughts around longer-term trends. And if you look at major asset classes like fixed income, where you can quantify long-term trends by just looking at yield to maturity, That nominal number is significantly higher today than it was a year ago, and so that's a plus. But, you know, clearly the equity market has been, you know, experiencing significantly higher volatility, you know, relative to just a year or 2 years ago. Even though volatility hasn't spiked recently, it's still elevated relative to any sort of historical analog. And so it makes sort of thinking about risk-adjusted returns quite difficult. It makes the 60-40 portfolio start to look a little more attractive just because we've seen that move higher in the front end in particular on the yield side, where, you know, twos today are at 3.42, and Fed funds are sort of pricing in the idea of maybe 3.75, 4% funds rate. And we know through the historical analog that two-year treasury yields in the peak in the Fed funds rate tend to generally coincide with one another. So it's a tricky time to think about the short term and try to tactically dip into this market. But in the long term, you know, we still think there are plenty of opportunities.
Well, let's talk short-term opportunities and then long-term opportunities. So what short-term should investors be thinking about? Or maybe if we're saying investors, we should say traders if we're thinking about short-term.
Right. So I think if you're thinking about timing, you're thinking about being tactical, when we try to be, you know, maybe marginally tactical, but more sort of structurally thinking long-term, you want to try to understand when the Fed's going to pivot or when the market's going to bottom. And so, you know, tend to look at things like the energy complex. You know, we haven't seen a collapse in the energy complex for sure. That tends to augur a bottoming in asset prices for equities. We haven't seen a collapse in valuations to any great extent. Usually valuations pierce through, let's say, 25-year averages. Even back in mid-June, we were trading not too far away from the 25-year average. And, you know, we haven't seen the Fed, as we just discussed, put their foot on the brakes and say, wait a minute, we're going to pause and assess and maybe even cut in the future. That tends to augur, again, a bottoming process in the market. So I think we probably have a ways to go if history is any guide here.
And I know it's often not this black and white, but I am curious, when you look at, you know, what we heard from Powell, the current setup in markets, what looks more attractive to you at this point, fixed income or equities?
Oh, gosh. Well, I think on a volatility-adjusted basis, based on just where yields are and the setup is, you know, certain components of fixed income, you know, look interesting. On a risk-adjusted basis. I think when you think about equities for the long haul on a nominal return basis, equities over, let's say, 10-year rolling period should return more. But I think that the trick will be is the willingness to accept incrementally higher volatility to achieve those returns relative to history. You know, the S&P returns over the last 10 years through December 31st were about 16.5%, while over the last 25 years, there were just under 10%. So just to sort of think about where we have to sort of revert towards the mean in the future to just capture that 25-year return, it suggests we could be going through a rougher patch of lower anticipated returns for equities.
Yeah, but, I mean, even that reversion to the mean is nothing to shake a stick at.
Well, I mean, it is. If we're moving from 16.5 to 9.7, it would suggest that we have significantly more downside and on a nominal basis, not just a real basis, in equities just to capture that longer-term return.
So, Aaron, I got to ask, because we're seeing declines now, especially after Friday, is the bottom in for this market cycle?
Well, I take a look at where we were in mid-June, Tim, and we had still a steep yield curve. I think twos tens were about 15 basis points. Now we have about a negative 30 basis point inversion. We had a dollar that, you know, dipped down about 101, 102, and now we're back up near 20-year highs. And we have a Fed that's sort of saying not so fast, whereas I think back in mid-June we had a Fed where at least the market perceived, you know, some sort of pivot around the corner, and we're trying to sort of anticipate that, and markets started rallying. And so I think that the probability that we're at a bottom level is still on the lower end of the spectrum, and that we could still experience some pain here. And I also sort of point to the reality that quantitative tightening is going to accelerate in September. It's going to double in size from August to September. That's more liquidity coming out of our capital market system. That's rarely a positive for the equity market and for credit.
Hmm. And Aaron Kennan, we love it when you take the time and join us. Thank you so much for joining us on Bloomberg Business Week this afternoon. Aaron Kennan is co-founder and CEO of Clear Harbor Asset Management. They've got over $1 billion in assets under management. Aaron joins us this afternoon from Stamford, Connecticut. You can follow him on Twitter at Aaron Kennon. That's AaronKennon.
Thanks for listening to Bloomberg Business Week. Download the podcast on iTunes, SoundCloud, or Bloomberg.com.
And you can also listen to our radio show at 2 p.m. Eastern on Bloomberg Radio or watch us on YouTube. Search Bloomberg Global News.
Join Bloomberg in San Francisco or virtually on May 7th for The Future Investor, Data-Powered Transformations. This 2024 event series will examine how data is not only playing a pivotal role in investment decisions, but serves as a driving force behind the construction of innovative, investable enterprises. This series is proudly sponsored by Invesco QQQ. Register at BloombergLive.com/futureinvestor/radio.